Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're back here. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Grays Lake, Illinois for Reformed Forum, and we have with us two wonderful folks today. Let me introduce to you at least one of our regular contributors, a board member, vice president of the board, and a faculty member here at Reformed Forum, Jeff Waddington, who also serves as stated supply at Faith OPC in Fawn Grove, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff. It's good to see you. 2 days in a row.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's great to be here on this pre-Thanksgiving Eve day, I guess we would call it.
Yeah.
Actually, my condo is already beginning to have the smells of Thanksgiving permeating, even as we're recording.
Yeah.
Off camera over there is my wife beginning to prepare for Thanksgiving Day.
Well, it's one of those things. Yeah, you know, we don't, again, know when the episode will come out exactly. I haven't looked at the schedule precisely, but that's what's going on in our lives. And so we're very excited today to be talking about some important things that touch on everybody, and looking at some foundational principles of economics, no less. Let me introduce to you today our guest. We have with us Dr. Sean Rittenour, who is a professor of economics at Grove City College. He also serves as a ruling elder at Covenant OPC there in Grove City. Welcome back, Sean. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Camden. It's a real honor to be invited and happy to be here.
I should say he's a first-time guest. I welcome back because we've known each other and have met. But anyway, welcome to the program for the very first time, and we're excited to speak to you today about economics, no less. Some people might be wondering why economics, and is this a fit for a theology podcast, and it absolutely is. And we're not going to get into all the finer points of economic theory, so to speak, but economics as a social science is a really important and significant endeavor. And our guest today, Dr. Rittenour, has written the book, Foundations of Economics, A Christian View. It's published by Whip and Stock. I believe it was 2010, so it's been out for a while, but the principles, of course, are still applicable and are not changing. And so, it's one of those things where people might not realize exactly what economics is about. But it's very important, and it's not just something, for politics or figuring out what policies need to be made. It's not just something for the news on television, but we're going to dive down into what economics is and how it pertains to the Christian and what a Christian ought to think, at least at a basic foundational level, about economics in general. But before we get into that, I do have just a few things to mention. Of course, Christ the Center is a listener-supported program. Our whole endeavor here at Reformed Forum, we're a nonprofit organization. We rely, of course, on the generous support of all of our listeners and viewers. And you can visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. We really encourage you to do that. We're excited about a lot of things that we have going on in the year 2020. A lot of travel, going to be doing a lot of events and speaking at several conferences, even in multiple countries and continents. I'm heading to Rome, we're heading to India, heading to Colombia, also places in the U.S. For various events and other things. Minnesota, where Jim and I will be speaking up in St. Paul in November. Where else? Going to Escondido, California to visit. Greenville, South Carolina. So there's a lot of things going on, and that's just to speak of the travel and the events. But then we also have several book publications that we're working on, book projects, and some other courses. So there's a lot going on at Reformed Forum. It's exciting times. It's busy times. But to engage in all this work, of course, we rely on your support. So we're very thankful for all of our especially steadfast supporters who've been with us for a long time, and there are several. But we encourage you, if you've benefited from our organization and our labors, if you could head on over to the website and contribute. We really, really do appreciate it, and we're very thankful for everyone who helps to make this possible. So that being said, let's turn to our discussion at hand today. Some people might not know, but I had a previous life. Not in some sort of mystical sense or anything like that. But before I went off to seminary, I worked at Caterpillar in Peoria, Illinois. And before that, I was at Bradley University, which is in Peoria. It's in central Illinois. And I studied business. And then after I finished my undergrad, I couldn't find a job because the economy was very bad and a lot of the businesses were not hiring. Plus, I was engaged and didn't want to move away from my fiance. So I was talking to my academic advisor, and he says, hey, why don't you just do a graduate degree? You could get into the MBA, and I've got some assistantships, and we'll pay you to go to school. And I said, okay. He goes, you won't live like a king, but you know, you won't be starving. So anyway, I went in and worked for the Bradley Center for Business and Economic Research. And we did a variety of things. We had a statistical composite of the Peoria area economy, where we did a lot of data gathering, and then put all that together. And that got published in the local newspaper every year, every quarter. And we also did, Sean, no doubt you know, the work at the University of Michigan for consumer confidence. We did a local version of consumer confidence reporting, and would feed that data into Ann Arbor, who would do whatever they would want to do with it, just to compare the differences nationally to some local numbers. So I wouldn't say I'm very skilled or good at economics, but I've always had at least a toe in the water with undergraduate and then graduate work in the subject. But I realize that most people are not that way. If you didn't do a business degree, then you haven't even had any general gen eds on the subject. And it's not necessarily something that's taught, if taught well, even in high schools. I know some high schools might have some basic economics courses. So Sean, I wanted to ask you really quickly, you know, let's take the word apart and talk about the basics of economics, because I think by doing that up front, we'll come to see how this is something that's in many ways very theological. It's dependent upon some basic theological principles. But the word itself, economy, comes from two Greek words, oikos and nomos, which simplistically just means house law. So what is economics? How would you define it? Because you do so in the book. But could you introduce the subject to us and just get our minds oriented in the right direction?
Yeah, thank you. It is kind of it's surprising how often people talk about economics without defining it well. And in some ways, it's because there are many different ways from which you could view it. Originally, the term did mean household management, something more like home economics. You know, how do you balance a family budget? A lot of times, even today, if people find out that you, like for me, I say, well, what do you do? I'm an economist. Oh, well, you know, can you help me? I've always needed help with my family finances.
Right.
Or, you know, can you tell me what the stock market's going to do?
Need some tips.
And I'm thinking, well, that's not really what economics as a discipline is really about. Economics is a social science by which we attempt to discover and derive and then express really what are laws of God's created order that constrain and give us guidance about how we can interact socially for people to achieve more of their ends, ultimately in a peaceful way. That's sort of the, shall we say, the practical aspect of it for us getting along in life. And that isn't all important. But once we recognize that economics is an effort to derive actual laws embedded in creation, well, then that takes on a different, that emphasizes or it takes on more weight, because like all scientific laws, they're reflections of the creator, they're reflections, manifestations of God's glory. And so that gives us even more reason to contemplate these things.
Yeah, certainly. You know, and it's a fascinating subject, because we start to get into human behavior and all sorts of things and relations, and how parties and not just individuals, but corporations and institutions and governments relate to one another. And, you know, yes. I'm sure you've heard your fair share of economic trinity jokes being an economist and a person interested in theology. And there are a lot of groans like, these jokes.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, the basic idea is not too ridiculous, because when we're speaking about the economic trinity, for example, we are speaking about how the persons of the Godhead relate to one another. And so, you know, that might be helpful for some people to think, well, if we have human beings living in the world, we're created in the image of God, and we have certain, well, God's righteousness, God's laws are expressed unto us, and we're supposed to live in a godly way, which means that we are supposed to relate to one another in a godly way. So this is very much, in a sense, kind of a study of the fifth commandment in terms of honoring your father and mother, but at least as the Westminster Confession describes and the catechisms on relating to superiors and inferiors. It's a study of how we as human beings ought to relate to one another and what that means for work, for labor, divisional labor, all sorts of things. So it's a in a sense it's a really important subject, and it's not just, you know, theoretical, impractical arguments about interest rates and whatnot, and what happens if we start fiddling with different aspects of the financial sector. Although that's important.
I was going to say, absolutely. One of the things that I had to, when I went to college, I had really no idea what I wanted to do. I thought about maybe going into business, kind of like you. And so the advisor had me take an econ class, and I really liked econ. I liked the microecon class that I took, a principles class, introductory class. And yet, in the back of my mind, I wanted to be confident that this wasn't just sort of something that caught my attention because it was sort of fun, entertaining, puzzle solving, in a puzzle solving sort of way. I wanted it to be something real. Could I hang my hat on it? And so I had to become convinced that that there was a connection between economic laws as we're being developed and shall we say, created reality that got in terms of the created order. And it was only after I sort of found that, no, this economic law is real because it's the way God made the universe and made us in his image. And as you pointed out, I mean, there's a reason why we call the economy the Trinity, because it has to do with the three persons doing specific things for purposes.
Right.
In the same way as human beings made in God's image, an aspect of that is the fact that we engage in purposeful behavior. We don't just react to stimuli. We don't just act by instinct, but we have a volition and moral responsibility.
Right.
So when we act with purpose, and that itself, in that way, we manifest show that we have God's image, and that's really that purposeful behavior, that what we call human action, is the basis, is the foundation, if you will, of the derivation of all the economic laws that we talk about in the discipline.
Very much.
Yeah, I would further add what you're looking at here is the cross section of natural or revelation and special revelation. So you're looking at God's word. You're also looking at God's, as you've already said, God's world, and you're deducing the laws that are at work, right? And so you look, and as you assess a given economic theory, you want to compare it to both the world and the word, and make an assessment based on that. So that's so I thought, and you and I, Sean, I think, had conversations at our OPC General Assembly a couple of years ago at Wheaton, where I had said that your book in particular and work was really looking at God's world and saying, this is how it works. So and it was almost a providence, a Proverbs and Ecclesiastes way of looking. You know, Solomon says in Ecclesiastes he wanted to look at everything and see how things work, and that's what we're doing. We're looking at how do people relate to one another, specifically in the monetary realm, although it's not you don't have to limit what we learn to that realm, but certainly that's the main thrust of what we're talking about here this morning.
Yeah, I would say the realm of exchange, be it monetary or non-monetary, and then just how we allocate the goods that we have, how do we use them to achieve our ends. And yeah, I think think of Proverbs, it was a Proverbs 6, go to the ant, thou sluggard, and be wise, right? He directs us to what he made. The heavens declare the glory of the Lord. So you have that aspect. And again, because because the laws of economics are essentially manifestations of our being made in God's image. These are not just these are not mental, these are not human constructs. Right? These are not
arbitrary
things that ideas that we have that have just been constructed in a particular context. They are things that are going to be manifested wherever humans act, and that's in all time and all places.
Right. So, you know, we've spoken about the man being made in the image of God, but also in Genesis, we see some other very important foundations for economic study. Again, we need to recognize the Bible is not an economics textbook. That's not the point. But the Bible does show forth God's inerrant, inspired truth. He's revealed himself to us, and that has massive implications for the study of economics, as it does for study of anything else, chemistry, physics, you know, technology, you know, what we do with it. But one of the big things in the garden is the cultural mandate given to Adam and Eve. And one thing that he's called to do is to be fruitful and multiply, but also to have dominion over the creatures, a dominion over all creation. So what does that word dominion mean, at least with respect and with regard to our subject of study today?
Well, it involves a couple of things. Clearly, it involves working, developing potentialities that are in creation. It means ruling. Right. It means exercising dominion means ruling, but it means dominion for use. The implication, as I understand it, and I'll stay from the beginning. I'm professionally trained as an economist. I'm not professionally trained as in biblical studies and or theology. As an elder, I have important interests there, and I'm sort of an amateur theologian, if you want to call it that. But I do try to use what I know well, right? And so I'm not saying that I do all the time. That's one reason why, for instance, my book, the subtitle is A Christian View, not The Christian View.
Right.
<It's>, you know, that's good. My Christian view might be an error in a number of ways. But in any event, the tasks that we find in the cultural mandate, filling the earth, ruling over creation is dominion for use, as I understand it. And so that means we don't, on the one hand, we don't we don't look at the earth as sort of our ultimate possession and we can waste it as we want to. We're called to, at the same time, we're called to work it. We're not called to sort of treat it as, you know, as my precious and, you know, not touch it. Following the admonition of MC Hammer, you know, can't touch this. We're called to work it, but then we're also called to keep it. Right? And that's the beauty of economics. Economics gives us knowledge about how people can be fruitful and multiply, not just numerically in terms of population, but also take what we have given and be fruitful in our use of the material creation. And at the same time, use it wisely, not spoil it, not waste it, not degrade it. And economics can tell us in certain institutional arrangements, human action is more prone to spoiling and wasting. In other social institutions, people have more, or in other social institutional frameworks, people have more incentive to use wisely and to conserve and maintain.
For certain. You know, another real basic, we spoke about the fifth commandment, but another real basic presupposition in all of this is the notion of private property. And that really strikes at the heart of a lot of these issues, especially in various conversations today about different basic structures and how different governments might order their society, whether that be, you know, capitalism or socialism or communism. All of these big questions need to come back to these foundational issues and see whether or not these systems are in accord with these foundational principles. But speak to us here about the presupposition of private property. I mean, how do we know that from Scripture? And really, what type of implications does that introduce to us here for economics?
Yeah, thank you. I really like the work of some of the 19th century theologians. The majority report, shall we say, the majority report of Christian history is that private property, or the right to property, as was often used, the right to property is a Christian, it's part of the Christian ethic, that you can go clear back to the church fathers and find this. And there's a strain all the way through the medieval period. I say majority report because there's always this, you know, not complete 100% agreement, but the vast majority of Christians recognize this.
Well, we also have an eighth commandment.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say. Yes. So, I mean, there's a reason why there is a majority report. Right. Exactly. Francis Wayland, I like, roots it, as he said, we know that the Christian ethic of property is Christian because of God's will tells us this. And he also cites our natural conscience, the general consequences, in other words, sort of a general revelation argument. But then he points us to Scripture. And so you look at God's word. We have many, many explicit prohibitions against theft, right? Thou shalt not steal being a well-known prohibition against theft. We have prohibitions against fraud. We have prohibitions against monetary debasement, moving property markers, keeping back wages that people are due. All of those prohibitions tell us that that people should not be defrauded of their property, either explicitly through taking or fraudulent dealings. And so people are to be secure in that. And what that means is that if I can't take what is yours and you can't take what is mine, then we, with respect to one another, are secure in our own property. Some people get nervous about this because that sounds like, oh, there's human autonomy there. And I would argue, no, that we know that there's ultimately a stewardship principle, right? The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. But then some people will draw a straight line from that to say some form of Christian socialism or whatever. And that forgets the rest of Scripture, which if God is the ultimate owner, then he is the one who decides who gets stewardship over what property and how people can lawfully come into possession of property. And he does this by the moral law that he gives us. And so the right to property is a correct way to understand Scripture. I mean, Charles Hodge, for instance, in his systematic theology, when he talks about the commandment against theft, he notes, he just says explicitly, it's on the basis of this commandment, we have the divine right to property. So, the right to property is not due to the will of man. It's not founded on the will of the state or the magistrate. It's not founded on, just some sort of practical homesteading principle. It's ultimately founded on God's moral law.
Can you, Sean, define for us what property is? Because I think it's more than physical stuff. Right. At least as it's understood within both Scripture. Well, I'm kind of getting at it. I'm leading you on, I guess. Would not property also include the entrepreneurial spirit? The capacity to create new things. Intelligence.
I would say that people are secure in their life. They should, morally, people have the right to life and property. And so, whatever comes out of themselves, whatever, I don't know if I would quite put it quite like that. I do think of property as the things that we possess, that we can then use to achieve certain ends. And in a way, okay, that includes us as a person. So, in that sense, we have the moral right to seek to engage in whatever productive activity we can engage in. And so, in that sense, it would include, yes, it includes the right to engage in some productive opportunity, which would be sort of an entrepreneurial venture. But on the other hand, I mean, one could turn it. It also, there's a constraint there. We cannot say on the basis of my right to property, then I could use my property to aggress against others.
Right.
We can't very well say, well, it's okay that I shot and killed my neighbor because I use my own gun. So that's, right. You know, okay. So that would be a violation. In the same way, I don't think we could say that, well, everybody has the right to be an entrepreneur, and then require the, say, somebody to take money from others to make sure that I can have my, you know, I can be a successful entrepreneur, even though I'm lousy at it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
correct. I was thinking more in terms of what we sometimes refer to as human capital.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good point. I think human capital actually is a concept is a little bit tricky because it's hard to, you're talking about skills and knowledge that you possess that, I mean, here I am using the word possess, but you have, but to what extent do you possess it? I mean, if it's in your mind,
right.
What does that imply?
It's more in the field of labor. Cause I mean, it's something you could sell, but you can't sell it independent of yourself.
Exactly.
So, you know, so I can hire myself out or offer my services to somebody, but then we have a form of exchange. It's not trading property. And, you know, then you also could blend into the area of intellectual property. Like I might know things and you might pay
That's
me to,
what I was
to,
getting at.
To the, teach you.
The point
you.
Is that property is a broader concept.
Yeah.
We need to define it broadly because if once you go into a look at, say, socialism or communism or mercantilism, your assessment of those economic systems is going to have with it some understanding of what God intends for us as human beings, how being made in the image of God relates to creativity and intelligence and volition and emotion. So the point is, it's very much a theological matter, and it's also a legal matter. It enters into... Yes, I was, when I asked the question, I actually had in mind what the framers of our U.S. Constitution had in mind when they talked about property. I can tell you that James Madison, when he had talked about property, meant more than physical, tangible stuff. He also meant a right to our own person and the fruits of our own labor. Yes, there are limits to that from a Christian perspective because we don't have the right to harm someone else, right? And so there are obviously we have to understand limits, but this all does enter into economics as in the broad sense.
Sure.
If we're going to integrate economics into the world in which we live.
Now, Sean, one thing you write in the book is that the object of economics is to discover economic principles that are true, so that policies developed in light of those principles will be suitable for achieving our goals. And then you also talk about in the book various economic laws we can discuss, such as the law of marginal utility, the law of comparative advantage, or the law of demand. But what I love early on in the book is that you also ask the question, well, how do we know these things? And you engage then in a brief discussion of epistemology. So if it's an economics book, presenting a Christian view of economics and understanding that the study of economics is in many ways a kind of an investigation of that connection between special and general revelation. But we need to engage in epistemology to even found this study correctly. Do you find that a strange thing? Not do you find it strange, but do you find your students when you're teaching epistemology in an economics class to kind of wonder why they registered?
Yeah, sometimes, yes. It's different for different students. Some students that are a little more philosophically bent, they tend toward philosophy. Not that philosophy students are bent, you know, something wrong with them. But you know, they have a certain philosophical leaning. They, I think, find it sort of naturally attractive. Others think, well, we're to hear about economics, and I teach a class called Foundations of Economics, which is a general elective social science credit. We have a Foundations of Social Science requirement in our general ed, and I have one of the offerings. And so students come in, and I think some of them expect it just to be sort of a survey of maybe micro and macro principles. But we teach it very much as a foundations. And I try to tell the students ahead of time, look, we are going to be dealing with the foundations because it's like any house. If we're going to try to explain or comment effectively on economic policy, like what should we do with taxes or monetary inflation or price controls and minimum wage, et cetera. Our understanding of that is going to be affected very much by our understanding of economic theory. That, in other words, if we increase a minimum wage above the market wage, what will happen? And it's economic theory that informs that. Well, our economic theory is only going to be as good as our understanding of the object of our study, which is humans and their actions. So if we don't have a proper understanding of human action, then we're going to have bad theory, which will lead to bad policy prescriptions. And so where do we get the information about human nature, what humans are like? Well, that deals with what we consider ultimate things, our theology and our philosophy. Well, that presupposes that we can know anything. And so I know for me, I was always one that wanted to get why? You know, to what extent can we be confident in this? Or am I just, going through mental exercises? And I found for myself and my other students, I think, too, a number of them are very gratified that, okay, now we have a reason why we can believe this. So if economics is a social science, it has to be a science. So how confident are we that we can pursue any scientific endeavor at all? And so I start walking them through and say, look, there are two things that are necessary for a science. One, scientific laws have to exist, and we have to be able to discover them. Right? Well, that presumes that we can know anything. And so I walk them through in a very broad brush fashion, because again, I don't have a graduate training in philosophy, but sort of lay out various theories of epistemology from skepticism through some empiricism and a priorism. And then I sort of end that chapter, as my first chapter, sort of explaining why a Christian view of creation is the one that satisfactorily allows us to begin learning anything. And then what God tells us about the creation and about ourselves gives us confidence that we can pursue science. And then a certain aspect of who we are allows us to find, and that aspect would be our purposeful behavior, that allows us then to say, oh, there is an aspect of human regularity that allows us then to develop economics as a social science. And so it's all rooted together.
You know, that's encouraging and tremendous, though. And I wish that people would study other disciplines with such rigor and trying to get down to the foundations there as well, because I imagine you go even to Christian universities, other Christian universities, and you take an introduction to chemistry course, and there might not be any thought or consideration to, where do these scientific laws come from and why is there regularity? To get down to these foundational issues is imperative. It's really important. And, maybe for many of the courses that's, you're reviewing some things that you covered in, other basic foundational courses, but they need to be expressed and we need to be reminded, because that's what it means for us to be faithful Christians, I believe. You know, one of the things you mentioned here early in the book, you've got a chapter on the general principles of human action and then the laws of human action. And economics, in many ways, is really a study of rational actors, humans acting and behaving within the world. But how can we speak about laws of human action? Because sometimes it seems like people are crazy and irrational. So help us out here and introduce to us some of these laws and what does that mean, and how is it useful for us?
Yeah, when I think the best way to understand it is to think of human action. When we talk about action being rational, what we mean is that just simply that people apply their reason, that they apply reason to engage in their purposeful behavior. In other words, our action is indeed applying means to achieve ends through some type of cognitive activity, some type of ideas that's linking the means and the end. So if I want to achieve whiter teeth and fresh breath, you know, I can apply toothbrush and a toothpaste and water and my own effort to brush my teeth. Why? Because I think that if I brush my teeth, I will achieve whiter teeth and fresh breath. So that there's the means, which is the things we use, the toothbrush and toothpaste, and the end, the whiter teeth and fresh breath. And then the idea is the linking the two, that if I use these means, I will achieve those ends. And that's really all we mean when we say rational action. It doesn't mean that we presume that people are choosing ends that actually are achievable. It's just that the people acting need to think that their ends are achievable. And it doesn't mean that we presume that if someone acts rationally, that people always choose the best means to actually indeed achieve their ends, right? People engage in, they make mistakes all the time, right? There's human error. And of course, sin also affects the ends that we have. It affects the means we think are suitable to our ends. And it can actually even, it can delude us into thinking that, you know, these ends will achieve these ends, or these means will achieve an end that doesn't actually achieve. So I think it was unfortunate as we went through the 20th century that the term rational choice got applied to a particularly narrow model that sort of assumes people acting with perfect information and assumes that people don't make any errors. I think a better approach, what I would say a sort of a realistic understanding of economics, would be that people do use their reason to act, but that does not preclude error. It doesn't mean that they're not affected by the thoughts of other people. A lot of people can be swayed by the opinions of others into doing things that in retrospect they look back and say, I wish I wouldn't have done that, but at the time it was reasonable and rational. So all we mean is that people are actually pursuing ends with a purpose.
Yeah. You know, this is where it gets into the real intriguing type of analysis. And some people, you know, amateur economists or even, you know, expert economists will like to get into some of these traditional problems. And when we're speaking about rational actors, sometimes it's hard to discern how, you know, what the principles are that somebody might be using. But the point is, people are using principles. They might not even be able to express them. But, you know, there are fields such as game theory, and one of the classic examples often people discuss is the prisoner's dilemma, which is an example of theoretically two rational actors acting, but they might not work together. In effect, they might not achieve the greatest outcome for themselves. You end up with these puzzles and problems. Sure. And so I suppose that, you know, we end up with real simplistic things sometimes in economic study where you're looking at like perfectly competitive markets and realize that the PC market doesn't exist anywhere.
That's right.
And can't.
That's
an idea. But it's not to say that in any environment we might study or any behavior of a human being that there aren't factors accounting for their behavior. Even if it doesn't appear that they're acting totally rationally, they might be prioritizing personal comfort or avoidance of conflict or, you know, all sorts of other things. It's not always as simple as trying to generate the greatest financial gain or whatever else. So economics is not merely finance. It's not merely the study of money or profit. It's the study of all the factors going on in human behavior and exchange.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a key point. That, and also, economics is not about how we think people should act. It's not about how people would act in ideal circumstances, however you define it. It's about how people actually act, given their constraints at the time. And so it may be that if we had full and complete information, people would act differently because they're certain about the future. But the fact is, people aren't, we cannot be completely certain about every aspect of the future because we're not God. You know, that's why James says, you know, if you don't say that you're going to do this or that, say if the Lord wills, I'll do this or that, because you don't know what tomorrow will bring. And so people have to act in an environment of some level of uncertainty. And so then the question becomes, what type of social institutions allow for the best outcome from the people's perspective, the actor's perspective, given their uncertainty? And we might say, well, in a perfect world, everybody should do X, but we don't live in a perfect world, and nobody can presume ahead of time what the optimal outcome would be. And so we have to sort of, these decisions are made bit by bit. Outcomes are achieved bit by bit as people engage in their own individual purposeful behavior.
We've gotten at the ideal versus actual distinction, which is very helpful, but there's nothing wrong with having the ideal, because that's in a sense the standard that we work from, right? So if we think of the ideal exchange, would be the free exchange. You have apples, I have oranges, I have more oranges than I want, you have more apples than you want, and so we figure out a way to, I want oranges, you want apples, we figure out a way to exchange our excess apples and oranges.
And then you're both better off for it.
Right. We're better. Mm-hmm. It's a free exchange in which both of us are better off because we don't have the same exact wants or desires, right? They're different. But the exchange is a way to satisfy desires.
Yeah. And it's a way to, yes. And it's a way to do that where people can be satisfied peacefully.
Yes.
And through voluntary action. So no one's getting a gun put to their head. No one's getting shot. No one's compound is getting burned down accidentally on purpose. it's a case where we engage, yes, in voluntary exchange. And I will say this, that those principles are true even in the hampered market in which we live. In other words, even though we don't have an actual free market, even though we don't have a free market where there's perfect information, we have where all firms are equally sized. We don't need any of that to understand. And the truthfulness of economic principles are not dependent upon those ideal considerations. Just the fact that we know what action is, that if people engage in action, voluntary action, then both parties, it's a mutually beneficial exchange. If people engage in exchange, it's mutually beneficial. Knowing that is in some sense all we need to know to understand that even in a situation where so we say price controls might be in place, even if that's the case, a voluntary exchange in a regime of price controls, the fact that the exchange is voluntary, that also demonstrates still that particular exchange is mutually beneficial. The price control will reduce the number of mutually beneficial exchanges in a society, but the exchanges that do take place are going to be mutually beneficial.
So one thing that often comes up when we're discussing, you know, economics, especially the Old Testament, arrangement in the theocracy. You know, there's a whole field of theological, I should say, a whole school of theology, you know, often called theonomy. And they'll often look at the Old Testament practice and then try, I'm oversimplifying, but try to generally model our present day society after the way that theocracy was structured. And so, help us out here, but how would you look at the Old Testament practices and what guidelines might you have for looking at the way that Israel was commanded to interact with one another, to behave, the principles of justice and basic economic principles enacted in Israel? How would you look at that? And then in what ways would you use that investigation or that example for ordering a present-day society that's not a theocracy, but nevertheless still bound by God's moral law?
Well, that's a really good question. sometimes I'll say, well, it depends on the day. I would not say that, the Old Testament civil law is an exact blueprint for civil laws today. Mm-hmm. I'm not of that strain. I think that there are general principles. You know, there's the phrase, the general equity of the law that can be applied. Certainly God's moral law is eternal. And so I do think that you can look back and see how some of these things are, you know, how, you know, in terms of even issues of liability, how different people are liable for how, you know, for what happens on their property, for instance, principles of restitution that we see. I think all that's very helpful. And I think it, to the extent that it, I mean, that is a reflection of the moral law as well, that the practical outworking of a person's what we would call a right to property and a right to life. I think that's all very helpful and can be used as guidance. I in many ways, I think there's a lot of aspects of how the Old Testament civil law handled things. There's a lot of things there that I think we can glean from, although I wouldn't put it there's definitely, it's not a one-to-one correlation,
yeah,
for sure. And this is a relatively vague answer perhaps, but I do think that in some cases I used to think that it was much more cut and dried. And I think that, because I thought it was cut and dried because when I was younger, I thought, well, that's the Old Testament. What does that have to do with anything? And I don't think that anymore. But I've spent some time looking at theonomic literature, and I found some of it attractive for a period, but ultimately found the Westminster standards persuasive, and also not in a theonomic way, I should say.
Sure, I think, you know, of course I'm not a theonomist, but I do also appreciate that language we have of the general equity thereof of the Old Testament.
Absolutely.
Law. And you know, there's tremendous, we should think hard about these hard questions and not be afraid of them, but we think about, right. Okay, yeah. We have a society with, you know, punitive you know, punishments, and we imprison so many people for so many crimes. And, you know, did we see that in the Old Testament? And we shouldn't be in a position where you say, well, this is just how we've done it as Americans or wherever we find ourselves. Right. So that's just how it is.
You raise an excellent point. I mean, you don't see a lot. You see in the Old Testament, you see restitution and you see execution. You don't find a lot of long-term imprisonment.
Right.
Right.
And I've often thought that I'm more attracted to that, not because I like the idea of a lot of executions, but I mean, in terms of, especially in terms of property, to when we're talking about theft and fraud, et cetera, et cetera. These days, right, you get your property stolen and somebody could go to jail. Somebody might get fined, but you don't see any of the money. It all goes to the state.
Right.
There's no true making amends that the offender doesn't make amends to the person directly. If they make amends, it's sort of through the abstract of imprisonment and everything to society, when society wasn't the one getting stolen from. It was right. A particular person in society right. Got stolen from. So yeah, I think there's a lot to be learned from looking at how God told the Israelites to handle crimes against person and property.
Mm-hmm. And before we get into maybe some more specifics of economic theory, because I'd love to ask you about that, maybe whet the appetite of some of our maybe more advanced listeners to talk about specific theories and especially your particular views and why you hold them. You know, maybe another example of something that can be a thornier issue is just the concept of interest, monetary, financial interest, you know, from borrowing money and being charged interest as a result, or earning interest on an investment. Because, you know, some people might read the Bible in some way and there's no allowance for charging interest to a loan from at least somebody within the covenant or within your family. How are you to think about these things given a capitalistic society? And, you know, is interest a biblical notion or totally unbiblical? Or how are we to negotiate some of these complex questions?
Yeah, that's a good question too. And again, I'm going to press as I understand it, first of all, people have tried to get around it by saying, well, usury is basically, you know, excessive interest.
Yeah.
And you know, when we talk about, and that sort of entered the legal code, usury laws are laws against, you know, ridiculous, like, you know, loan shark rates. Well, I don't think that's not when the script, when the King James used usury, he meant interest, right? So yeah. It's against the charging of interest, not excessive interest, but interest. Now in that economy, as I understand it, the primary, if not exclusive, charging of interest would be for loans when people are in dire need, that right. we have, they're under extreme need, extreme circumstances, and there then were prohibitions against essentially profiting over someone's serious hardship.
Yeah, malady, right. Mm-hmm.
And so by the time we get into the New Testament era, the time of Christ, we see that there are there's more commercial lending or financial lending, and we don't find the same sort of blanket prohibitions, or to the extent that we, how should I put this? We don't find the interest for that type of loan is not the same as interest charged, say, for a charitable loan. So I would say that there is no scriptural prohibition against sure. interest.
And Jesus speaks of the
for commercial purposes.
The manager of the house, you know, he gives out his talents to his employees, and one of them buries them, and he chides yes. the man for, you know, even the one of the laziest options he could have done is just put it in the bank, and then he yes, would have at right. least got interest and as interest. A return. And so now that's an investment, but at the same time, yes. If we flip it, you're giving the bank a loan. So it's, yes. you know, the same principles at work, and Jesus does not, of course, denounce that. Neither does he denounce right. as, you know, morally outrageous the idea of taxes. He encourages us to pay taxes even to a you know, pretty horrific institution as the Roman
right.
government.
Yes.
And so these are, we see glimmers of this, and there are economic principles to be derived from, yes. from Jesus' own words and teachings where we might not necessarily expect them.
Right. And it's always tricky because, I mean, I would never want to say, right, we'd never want to say that, well, the purpose of this parable is to legitimate,
yeah, right,
you, you know, interest, right? right? That's not the point of the parable.
It's
however, it's interesting, you know, what the moral force of the parable sort of requires, though, understanding it in a certain way.
Right.
I mean, if we're going to say that interest is out of bounds, why would wouldn't the person be better bearing the talent than putting it at putting it in
yeah,
the bank?
Yeah, than committing
interest.
A sin by investing.
Right, exactly.
How would you get fivefold or tenfold, right?
Yeah.
The expansion of the talents presupposes some sort of an interest accruing
yeah,
mechanism,
system.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
At work. Otherwise, there wouldn't be the parable.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the whole field of currency is fascinating to me, especially with all the changes and now this new frontier and the speculation of cryptocurrency and all this sort of thing. It raises up these foundational issues of what is money and where does it derive its value and power, you know, and who authorizes it and all sorts of things like that, especially with these decentralized models. But that's probably a conversation for another day. I'd love sometime also to talk about the ethics of intellectual property and, you know, open source movements and that sort of thing. I know that's something Vern Poitras is really interested in. But before, you know, trying to wrap up and, you know, and go a little bit beyond, I'd love to ask you about the Austrian School of Economics. And just for, if you could maybe give to us some very basics, you know, in principles and why, as a Christian, a thoughtful Christian, you are very much in favor of this Austrian school and Ludwig von Mises, correct? Am I getting that?
That's correct. Yeah. You're correct.
Some people
very
might
good.
Say Mises. But, you know, I know you're involved in the Mises Institute. Introduce some of that to us because it might be something that people want to explore further. And I'm really, you know, would love to hear why, as a thoughtful Reformed Christian, this is a school of thought that you're very sympathetic with.
Yeah. As I said, when I was a college student, I was attracted to some of the ideas, the type of questions that were being asked in my microeconomics class, and the general analytical framework we used to answer these questions. And yet at the back of my mind, I was still thinking, okay, is this real, or are we using, say, models that are founded in sort of arbitrary assumptions? And they may be plausible, but then some maybe not. And so I'm trying to sort this out. Well, because I wanted to get the complete works of Francis Schaeffer for $10, I joined the Conservative Book Club. And I got the Francis Schaeffer books, which I enjoyed. And then I also bought one of their alternative selections, which was Mises's book, Human Action, which is his big economics treatise. And I started reading that. And the first 142 pages is his sort of foundations of economics. And he roots it all in purposeful economic, purposeful behavior, as we've already described here. And it was reading that book that seeing how, so that view of economics rooted in human action is then linked to, as I was putting it together, my own understanding of human nature was linked to that, linked that sort of the Christian view of man is integrated with this idea of purposeful behavior the way Mises outlined it, and then building economics up from there. That provided me sort of the link of economics with a firm Christian foundation, or pursuing economics within a Christian worldview. And so so I thought, well, this then makes sense. And so I just read and studied more Austrian economics, called Austrian because the three main figures were in Vienna, grew up in Austria, studied in Austria. But in any event, it's a body of economics that is rooted in human action. And it notes that when people engage in action, that by itself implies a lot of other economic categories that are true or there whenever people act. So, for instance, engage in an action means we do something rather than nothing, right? I'm here participating in this program. I could be doing something else, but the fact that I'm here demonstrates that I prefer to be here on this program than doing whatever else I would be doing. Well, that in itself implies value. People have to rank their ends. Which do I want to achieve? Which one do I want to set aside? That implies the concept of value. It implies the concept of benefit versus cost, the benefit that I get of the action versus the cost of what I forego. That implies then the concept of profit or loss. So all of these concepts then are manifestations or implications of the fact that humans act. And then we start thinking, okay, when people act to achieve certain ends, they want to, they'll act to achieve the highest end first, and the second most highest end, and the third, et cetera, et cetera. That leads us then to this, like I said, the laws of marginal utility, and the law of returns. All of these laws then are not hypotheses that need to be verified by data. They're laws that are necessary laws, necessary implications of human action. The laws are manifest in empirical analysis, right? So you could go and collect data, and you will find that these laws are verified. But the laws are not true because they're verified. They're true because they're implications of a premise that we know to be true, that people act purposefully. And so that's the methodological basis for it. And then out of that comes, you apply the law of marginal utility, you derive the law of demand, the law of supply, you can derive the law of comparative advantage. These are actual economic real laws that then we can apply to all, a host of different topics.
Sure.
From which we get all of economic law, all economic principles.
When we're talking about this school of economics, sometimes, people have different, whether or not their assessment is accurate is another question. But sometimes, go read whatever your favorite topic on Wikipedia, for example, and you see all of the fighting and stuff as different proponents of different positions are trying to fight out for what's going to be said about something on the Wikipedia page. But if you read about the Austrian school on Wikipedia, and again, giant caveat because it's Wikipedia, although it's often very useful, but they speak of the Austrian school as a heterodox school of economic thought. It's like, okay. And then that it's based on methodological individualism. And you've been speaking about the idea that this is rooted in human behavior, and it's important that we see that. And I think that's can be a very appropriate and attractive way to approach this as a Christian. But how would the Austrian school speak to group dynamics, for example, or the social environment or corporations? Because, I would just like to give you the opportunity to defend this against maybe some detractors who haven't maybe fully understood your particular school or approach to economics on this front.
Yeah, thank you. And there's a lot of misconception there. When we talk about methodological individualism, that is a methodological, it's important to understand from the beginning, that's a methodological principle.
Yeah.
It's not an ethical principle.
Yeah.
It's simply recognizing the fact that when a person acts or when anybody acts, it's always a person or even a set of persons that act, but the actions are always carried out by somebody. Right? For instance, if we're talking about a corporation, well, the corporation, Acme Corporation, does this or that. Mm. Well, no, it's somebody in that corporation that makes a decision to do that, right? It's the CEO of the corporation that decides this, or the CEO gives a directive to a lower manager, who then gives a director to the manager that's right in contact with people and or at the production line, and that person makes a decision. And so, I mean, Mises makes the point that it's the hangman that executes the criminal, not the state. And he's not denying that the state can be responsible for executing a criminal. It's not that the state's not responsible, but he's saying the person that actually pulls the lever is the hangman. In other words, even an action of a group is dependent upon the actions of an individual.
Right.
And it's purely methodological. That does not imply that people are islands, right? That they're autonomous little entities that don't care about anybody else. That their actions are not affected by anybody else. It just means that when people act, it's their own person that acts. Now, all of us are influenced by a whole host of things, right? So when somebody acts, of course, they're going to be affected perhaps by, you know, what their parents have taught them, what their friends think about things, what other people out in society think about things, what they've learned in church, what they've learned in other social groups. All of these things will impact what a person does. But it's still the person that does it. That's all I mean by that.
Well, and that's getting at striking as something that rubs me the wrong way with the United States, and especially with a recent Supreme Court decision called Citizens United. And it's a whole philosophical issue of whether corporations can be treated as people, and if they are treated as people, whether they deserve constitutional rights within our country. Now, I don't want to get too political, but we're already in the space. I don't think that's appropriate at all. Because then you theoretically could have every individual as part of that corporation has kind of double protections, or you know, could a corporation have a protection for free speech? But it doesn't really make sense to me, because then you end up with individuals effectively receiving more votes than other people within the democratic society. But that's my own personal view. But I might
challenge that and say that the very idea of a corporation is to treat a group as an individual legally.
But my point is, a corporation only exists as a collection of people, of individuals. And when we think about ultimately, you know, the relationship between God and rational actors, I mean, God does treat Israel as a group of people, and there are implications for the group, even based upon the actions of certain individuals within that group. But when we're thinking about, let's fast forward all the way to final judgment, corporations or groups or institutions are not standing before the Lord in judgment. There's a one-to-one relationship. And so my thought is, you know, on this principle, is does that demand that we think of economics or our method in various ways? And of course, we can think of groups and institutions relating to one another. We have to. It does affect behavior. But what is the ultimate and most foundational principle of accountability? And everyone has to come before the judgment seat. And so it's an interesting thing to think about, you know, where the account is and what might that mean for investigation into creation. And so I think this methodological individualism isn't necessarily shouldn't be cast aside outright without some deeper thought. And some people do that. So anyway, what do you think about that, Sean? Am I way off base here?
I'm not sure I'm prepared to comment on that. I will say this again, the principle is only a methodological one.
I got you. I know. I'm extending
it. It's not a legal principle. I'd have to think more about that particular relationship. And again, my views on the issue you raised with regard to corporations, it kind of depends on the day.
Yeah, I hear you.
I need to think more about that, actually.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
That's an interesting point.
I'm not dead set on my own views.
In some sense, I think in many ways, the principle of limited liability has been much abused. I've often wondered if we could get away from, if we were closer to holding individuals accountable for the actions of that the individuals take, we all would be better off, even in a corporate environment.
No, I get you there. And it's complex. I'm thinking in a very limited, specific sense in terms of, you know, does Corporation A deserve, you know, the protections of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, for example.
Right. I mean,
which was intended for individuals. That's a different question.
If there is corporate ownership, public corporate ownership, then it does seem to me that the shareholders have
the
rights that they have. And so do they have, does the corporation is owned by the shareholders, if the corporation is perceived as having particular rights as a quote unquote person, is that merely simply saying that the shareholders have the constitutional rights that are then, you know, manifest in the corporation? I have to think more about that, but that's the thought that comes to mind.
But you've landed yourself in the Hobby Lobby case.
Well,
we've landed ourselves there because if you go the route that you are suggesting, Camden, I think Hobby Lobby was not a corporate.
No, they're private
corporation.
It's different.
It's the Green family, so it's a different. But I can see. Actually, what we're doing is we're pointing out the necessity of thoughtful consideration of these matters, right?
Sure.
In other words, there's not an obvious answer. You actually have to stop, slow down, and think about these issues. And what we've also discovered, at least from what I can see, is that the economic, the legal, the theological, the social, all of these things interact. And so to dismiss Austrian economics because of a methodological commitment to the individual actor is, of course, it might even be guilty of reification, which is a logical fallacy. I'd have to give more thought to that.
I put a monkey wrench in the gears here to finish off this episode, but I think raising some of these issues at least gets us thinking and realizing that our theological study has a lot more to say and as it ought to about daily life and about the choices that we need to make and the thoughtful Christian who's studying his or her Bible and trying to understand God's revelation is we're not at full liberty just to do anything we want in the world any way we want. That God has taught us and he's given us principles, and then there are also good and necessary consequences from what he's revealed unto us that touch upon everything, even upon the way that society ought to be structured, you know, issues of interest, issues of retribution, all sorts of things. And, you know, I appreciate very much then your thoughtful consideration, Sean, and also for writing this book, because it reminds us of those things and also takes a deeper dive into the study of economics, helping us to understand how Christians can be more faithful economists. So thanks so much for writing the book, and I want to encourage you to do more work like this as you have opportunity. But of course, thanks so much for taking the time to speak to us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you. I've had a blast.
Good. We'll have to follow up and talk more about some of these other things on the plate. We could do our own homework and perhaps talk about some thornier issues down the road. But this has been tremendously enlightening. And the book should be available, I imagine, through Amazon or any other general bookseller, as Whip and Stocks, a good solid publisher, and you can yes. find it there. The book on a Christian view of economics in this foundation series. So check it out, and we'll have links to it in the episode description for people to get a hold of it. And what's the website for Grove City College again? I'm not thinking of it offhand.
GCC.edu.
You know, excellent. And of course, a wonderful institution doing things a different way, not reliant upon federal money, yes. which also affords certain freedoms, and just a top-notch, world-class, you know, excellent education there, Grove City College, and encourage people to check that out, especially if they have students or in their congregations or family members who might be heading off to university. It's a great option. Take a look at it. It could work for you. I do want to point people to the website, our website, reformedforum.org, where you'll find information about all of our programs, upcoming events, and our publications and courses. You can find it there. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so through the website or by emailing us at mail@reformedforum.org. We're on all the usual places as well, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you name it. We're out there. We want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.